Jay, thanks very much, and it's nice to be back here. Although this is the first time I've been in, I think, on this particular campus. I did notice as I came in through on Compact Drive and past, I don't know, HP Square it was, whatever it was, I was surprised at the shortage of Carly Fiorina bumper stickers. I'm going to talk about a very particular recent experience, including my own personal experience, which had to do with the effort of the Greek government that was elected in January of this year to achieve a better deal with its European creditors, with the IMF. And this is, I think, just an interesting example of the challenges and difficulties, maybe a parable, if you like, of the challenges and difficulties of the kind of work that I know that you're engaged in, which is to seek justice and to improve the condition of our fellow citizens. Greece is a country with a difficult modern history that became independent of the Ottomans in the 19th century and has been in default on its debts, I'm told, for about half of the time since then. It fought an unusually bitter, tough battle, brutal battle against the Nazis in World War II. When I was there this summer at a meeting, there was someone working on that issue showed a map of 1,000 places which suffered a loss of a quarter or more of their population in that battle. After the Second World War, it went through a horrific civil war, which had the peculiar property that the partisans who fought the Nazis were on the losing side, defeated amongst others by the British and ourselves. And the post-war governments were drawn from largely from forces that had not been on our side during the Second World War. In 1967, there was a military coup, and for 7 years, Greece lived under a fascist dictatorship, only ended in 1974. Democracy and, let's say, European modernity only really began to consolidate in Greece after that period. Greece joined the European Union in part to further that political project. It began under Andreas Papandreou, an economist who had much of his career as an academic in the United States, to develop the elements of a European welfare state, including, for example, public health care system. And it came into the Eurozone when the Euro was created in 1999-2000. It's fair to say that none of this was terribly well done. Greece never developed a modern public administration, and its government through this period continued to alternate between a clientelistic socialist party, PASOK, and an oligarchic conservative party called New Democracy. And especially during the first years of the Eurozone, Greece lived, as other countries of peripheral Europe did, by accumulating debts. The Eurozone was created in a way which was fundamentally flawed, and deeply incompatible, in fact, with a functioning continental economic system, with the almost immediate consequence when it came into existence that Germany began to build up large surpluses, trade surpluses, partly the excellence of German industry, partly the fact that Germany pursued an aggressive policy of lowering wages in Germany. And these two things meant that German financial surpluses started building up, and all the other trading partners in Europe started running increasingly large deficits. And that was true of Italy, it was true of Spain, it's true of Ireland, France, and Greece. Those deficits had to be covered by borrowing, which in different countries of the periphery of Europe was done in different ways. In Ireland, for example, there was a boom in commercial real estate. In Spain, there was a boom in residential housing construction. In Greece, it was largely public borrowing. There weren't that many private, industrial, or commercial interests that had access to credit. The state did a great deal of borrowing. It borrowed to support one of the larger military budgets in Europe, including to purchase tanks and submarines from the Germans, fighter planes from the French. These were not exactly, in every respect, the most pristine contracts you could imagine. The German submarines had the slight problem that the hulls were curved, you know, a bit like a banana, which is not a good, it's not an attractive feature in a submarine. It means if you put it in the water, it tilts. I never learned where it list, whether they listed to the left or the right, but the result was basically they never left dry dock. There was also a lot of infrastructure spending, some of it useful, some of it white elephant. There was the Olympics in 2004, a costly project which, as Olympics tend to do, leaves a lot of disused athletic facilities lying around and a lot of debts that remain to be paid. And there were also deficits in the public services, the healthcare service, for example, which were carefully covered up with the complicity of European authorities. These were boom times. Greek wages rose, Greek unit labor costs rose, but they were boom times that were built on a completely unsustainable foundation with the complicity of the lenders and of the European statistical authorities, the lenders in question being largely commercial banks, French banks, German banks, and Greek banks, which were owned by the French banks to a substantial degree. In 2007, 2008, of course, the financial world fell apart. And that meant necessarily the end of this particular phase of economic activity. The financial world fell apart, as we all know, for reasons that originated in this country initially. The world's largest wave of mortgage financing fraud in human history. Fraudulent mortgages that were securitized by our major banks, given AAA ratings by our ratings agencies, and peddled all around the world, but especially to Europe, especially to Germany, to naive investors who thought that they were dealing with reputable companies and reliable ratings procedures. And when it became clear to the world that this was not the case, and that investors were going to suffer massive losses, and in some cases banks were going to fail, major German bank EKB failed quite early in the process, the world investment community, naturally enough, panicked, became extremely cautious, and began to look around for assets that they held that they could get rid of that might be risky. And that meant the bonds, basically, of all of the peripheral European countries, especially Greece. And so the credit markets just closed. Now, you can always point to the intrinsic weaknesses of the initial credit, but the reality was that an event happened which was not just related to Greece, it was related to the world financial system, to the United States, and to Europe, and it had comparable effects all through the European periphery. The Irish lost credit, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Greeks. They all went into an economic crisis. At the same time, at the end of 2009, the Greek elections were held, and the socialists, having been out of power for a number of years, came back in under George Papandreou, the son, elder son of Andreas, a very nice man, by the way, who was born and raised in Minnesota and so has the very unusual personality characteristic for a Greek, which is that he doesn't talk all that much. But this new government was faced with the reality that they were in charge of a bankrupt state. And having been elected on what were, I think, honest promises, or as far as Greek politics go, of a continued move toward the development of a just and fair society, they had to reverse course almost immediately and recognize that they were, in fact, presiding over a bankruptcy, and had to ask for the assistance of the creditor community to manage that bankruptcy. And this brings us to the period leading up to the first creditor deal, which occurred in May of 2010. What did the creditors do? The creditors, who were the large banks, basically sought help from their political leadership in France and Germany, in Washington, to get themselves free and clear of the situation. And they got that help. They had the debts moved from their books onto the books and the backs of the taxpayers of Europe and of the IMF. And so a massive loan was made that was passed through Greece, not to the benefit of the Greeks, but to enable the banks to escape losses, which is what, in fact, occurred. A large part of that loan was made by, say, European taxpayers. A certain part was made by the European Central Bank. A certain part was made by the International Monetary Fund. I could go into each of those in detail, but let me just take up the piece of the International Monetary Fund, which made the largest loan in its history relative to the quota, the membership share, ownership share of a member state in 2010, 32 times quota. Why did it do it? For two reasons that had nothing to do with Greece. One was that the IMF was a failed institution at that point. Latin American and other countries that had been dealing with had stopped and were no longer borrowing and therefore no longer paying to the IMF, so the institution was running out of revenue, needed something to do. Or else, you know, you might be faced with it closing, which would have been interesting. And the other reason was that the managing director of the IMF, I don't know if you remember this man, he's a man of impeccable probity and sort of deep moral character, the Mother Teresa of modern economics, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, wanted to become president of France. And if you want to become president of France and you're a French socialist, being in the good graces of the French bankers is a good idea. That is why the IMF went into Greece. We pay for the IMF, you pay for the IMF. So you ought to be aware as you think about this that it is possible for your taxpayer dollars to be used for a completely unjustifiable loan in order to help the political ambitions of somebody who happens to be sitting in the managing director's chair in a country that isn't even us. Right? If it were Carly Fiorina, I'm sure you would have all be quite okay with that, but we're not talking about it. All right. So what was essentially a dirty bargain was made in 2010. The dirty bargain was covered by a dirty projection made by the economists of the IMF, which held that this would necessarily be a recessionary policy. There's no question about that. That was baked in. But that the Greeks would suffer a 5% loss of GDP and that there would be a recovery after a few years. That projection was repeated basically for five consistent years. Every year, you record another decline and predict another gain. Okay. This is in the nature of Einstein's definition of insanity, always doing the same thing and expecting a different result. What actually happened was that the Greek economy broke under the strain. Greece was required, under the cover of this projection, to implement a set of policies. Policies of deep fiscal contraction, the largest adjustment, so to speak, that is to say, set of cuts in Europe. 300,000 public servants were fired. Taxes were raised, pensions were cut by 44% to 49% on average, and the pensions were not high to begin with. But now if you are a 30-year senior civil servant with 30 years of service, your pension was then about going to be €1,200 a month. Okay? That's what we're talking about here. And one could go down the list. Greece was required to start privatizing a whole raft of public assets and to do so very rapidly. And it was required basically to deregulate its labor movement, its labor market, that is to say, to stop dealing with trade unions and to cut the minimum wage. A radical experiment in neoliberal policy. And what happened over the 5 years that followed was that Greece broke under the strain. It broke under the strain. Unemployment went up to 25-30%. Unemployment for young people up to 60%. Suicide rates, homelessness, all kinds of things which were quite unfamiliar, basically, in Greece, in modern Greece, began to rise very rapidly. And you could see the decline both in the urban environment of Athens, which if you've been there, you see covered with graffiti, empty storefronts, pawn shops, a real case study in urban decay and collapse. Thessalonica, just as bad. And in the faces of the people, many of whom have recently been displaced from what were ordinary middle-class existences. And there was a rise of political reaction to that in 2011-2012 of the Nazi Party. This country that had fought the Nazis began to experience its own Nazism, a group called Golden Dawn, which applied what were textbook Nazi practices, street terrorism, death threats to people, murder in one case of an artist, and a political platform that included, right there on the page, concentration camps for immigrants. So things were going in a very dangerous direction. But what happened at that point was something quite extraordinary and interesting, and something which I was privileged to be quite close to, actually, and which was that for once, there began to be articulated in the middle of the crisis a very clear-cut progressive alternative. That progressive alternative grew out of the political formations that had been marginalized since the Civil War. But it was also very modern, something quite new and quite precise. It was turned on two people in particular. One of them, a very talented young political figure, former student organizer, trained as a civil engineer, by the name of Alexis Tsipras, who began to pull together a very fractured Greek left, the exclusion of the old Communist Party, which remained quite hostile, but a very fractured Greek left, trade union organizers, student organizers, political militants, ecologists, and college professors, including expatriate college professors, from Scotland and from other places, into a political group called the Coalition of the Parties of the Radical Left, which in Greek is Syriza. And the other one was an economist, a Greek who had been educated in Britain, taught in Australia, and had returned to Athens 4 or 5 years previously, named Yanis Varoufakis. And Yanis had become, by 2010, 2011, a protean source of critical argument information, basically through his blog and books written in both Greek and English, and had become a phenomenal figure locally in Greece, and I got to know him in 2011. There wasn't a waiter in any restaurant in Greece or an airport security guard or a taxi driver who didn't know exactly who he was or prepared to. This is a guy who sold, his books in Greek sold 110,000 copies in a country of 11 million people. That's one for every 100 people. That's J.K. Rowling scale, except for the fact that the publishers were bankrupt, so he never earned any royalties from them. I got to know Yanis in 2011 and in 2013, partly because it wasn't entirely wise for him to remain in Greece in this period. I was able to persuade my colleagues at the University of Texas at Austin, and particularly at the LBJ School, to bring him to Austin for a two-year teaching visit. And so we were working quite closely through this period. And in 2013, we actually held a conference at which we arranged for the first overseas visit of Alexis Tsipras and his team, two or three of whom are now still in the cabinet in Greece, but people who had never been in political power up to that point. What Yanis helped to articulate for the Greek left was a program for Europe, a program that was aimed at trying to fix some of the big flaws that were affecting the Eurozone, but particularly affecting Greece. This was called the Modest Proposal, and I joined it, a later draft, as a co-author, along with Stuart Holland, who had been one of the architects of the European Union to begin with. What we sought to do was to work on a program to help relieve the debt burden of all the crisis countries, to provide a New Deal, an investment program through the European Investment Bank, to provide new mechanisms for getting rid of toxic banks that are linked to toxic politicians, a bank resolution mechanism, and a solidarity mechanism which was built on the food stamps program, actually, which is my idea, that you would do something that was targeted from the European Center, that was targeted directly to the most vulnerable and needy people, get school lunches going and nutrition assistance. And actually, that piece was actually implemented at the national level in Greece in January when the new government came in, February. And as a result of that, and parallel movements inside Greek politics, one had an extraordinary rise of this coalition of ragtag and utterly implausible political figures. And if you meet the people on the political the Syriza Central Committee, you will discover that a gathering of them would look rather like a gathering of you. And this is the Central Committee of the party that is now in government in Greece. To say a political miracle that they were able to rise through the European Parliament elections in May of 2014. Actually, 2012, Alexis became the leader of the opposition. 2014, Syriza became the largest party. In December of 2014, because of a feature of the Greek constitution, they were able to force the government of Antonio Samaras to call elections in January 25th of 2015, Those elections were held, and Syriza won one seat short of an absolute majority of the parliament, 149 out of 300 seats, and was able to form a coalition very quickly. On the 26th of January, Yanis Varoufakis became a designated finance minister, became finance minister of Greece, and I got an email that said, get here as soon as you can. So I went. I got there in February 8th, which was the day that the Greek parliament opened, and it was an extraordinary scene. Yanis had dismissed the two armored cars that were previously used as limousines for the finance minister in favor of his Yamaha 1300cc motorcycle. Watching from here, his wife was a little worried about his security, but once I got there, I realized the guy had 11 million bodyguards. It was, you walk across Syntagma Square, a large crowd would form, as if kind of phalanx all around, holding up their cell phones. Go to the street, the cars would roll down their windows and honk their horns. A bus driver stopped, rolled down his window, and saluted. Schoolgirls going by broke ranks, gathered around it. This was a sense that of catharsis that the Greek people had, after 5 years of being beaten into the ground, found their voice and were prepared to go back to the negotiating table in Europe to cut a better, more functional deal. Yanis was under no illusions about this. When I arrived at the finance minister, the first thing he said to me was, welcome to the poison chalice. That's the title of my book, by the way, coming out next spring. And as we walked across in the crowd, he said to me, I wonder if they'll still be with us when the banks are closed. This is in February. We knew from the beginning that this was not going to be an easy deal. But we went up, and I was part of this. I flew with the Greek government in a dusty Embraer up to Brussels 3 days later and spent the first week of the negotiations trying to assist the Greek negotiating team, which had been pulled together in a scratch fashion, people who had never been in this position before, to try and work out a better deal with the European partners, so-called partners. The nature of that deal, we were quickly aware, we simply was not going to be a European solution. There was no interest in discussing European-wide policies. And so one had to focus on the specific terms that were being imposed on Greece. Could you get a basic deal that permitted labor unions to function according to the standards of the International Labor Organization available to every other country of Europe? Could you get a reasonable macroeconomic stance so that you're not constantly having to try to pile up cash in order to pay debts? Could you get protect the pensions of people who are earning 350 euro a month? Right? And there are hundreds of thousands of those in Greece, already destitute, and they wanted to take another 120 euro away from those people. That's what we were dealing with. Could you stop the fire sale privatizations that were bringing in no money, but just giving away airports and ports and electric utilities and every other kind of public facility, water companies, basically for free to anybody who wanted to use them to jack up rates and impose a further monopoly on the Greek people? That's what we ended up asking for. Negotiations over some other things, tax rates and so forth. Those are the four essentials, those four red lines. Who were we negotiating with? The answer was initially, in the first instance, with the creditor institutions. The European Central Bank, European Commission, the International Monetary Fund. But it was very clear that the Greek government was dealing with ciphers, with functionaries, with people who did not have authority to make concessions. And so they would talk endlessly, and they dragged very limited manpower of the Greek government to Brussels for endless program reviews and consultations and discussions, but with very, very little capacity to actually decide anything. That was the institutional level. Then there was a level called the Eurogroup, which is the finance ministers. Finance ministers are the 19 members of countries who are in the Euro. And that was a very interesting and rather grim experience for Yanis, who was basically in those meetings by himself. Because you had the East European countries who have become rigidly ordo-liberal, that is to say, Friedrich von Hayek free market enthusiasts, and they would not make a single concession because it was against their political program at home. And you had the Southern European countries, the conservative governments of Spain, Portugal, also Ireland, who were threatened by rising left-wing movements with close ties to Syriza, Podemos in Spain, the left bloc in Livre in Portugal, Sinn Féin in Ireland, who wouldn't make any concessions because that would undermine their political position. And you had the French and the Italians who were sympathetic, the French especially, but I'm afraid didn't have any nerve. And you had the Germans, who were trying to exercise a leadership role in Europe. Social Democratic Party identified with PASOK, which had been defeated by Syriza, and therefore it hated us. And the conservatives, well, the conservatives actually were quite honest. I don't want to speak harshly of Wolfgang Schäuble, with whom the Greek government had frank and direct dealings. But Schäuble is a very conservative man and would not make any concessions and was clear from the beginning. So what did we do? What did the Greek government do? It went to a third level, so-called political level. And the object of the game became, could we persuade Chancellor Merkel to cut the Greek government and the Greek people some slack in order to consolidate the leadership position that she has over Europe? And who could persuade her to do that? Well, there's some people who thought Vladimir Putin might, that was an illusion, but there were others who thought that Barack Obama might. That was a somewhat more serious effort, which, well, I was engaged in. I was involved in keeping the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, the White House informed so that they would understand what the Greek government point of view was and not become captive to hostile opposition forces with whom they obviously had all of their established contacts. And I have to say the president was quite sympathetic. By a pure happenstance, Yanis Varoufakis was the only finance minister who came to the World Bank Fund meetings to meet with President Obama for 12 minutes at a public, at a reception in the White House. The president, in a marvelously presidential choice of words, said, "I sympathize with you, austerity sucks." But at the end of the day, it's fair to say the government of the United States simply did not have or did not choose to exercise real leverage with Chancellor Merkel. And it became a question for her of would she have to concede, or would she just try to get rid of a left-wing government in Europe? And frankly, she had had experience getting rid of governments. She had gotten rid of Papandreou, George Papandreou in 2011. She'd gotten rid of Berlusconi. So we could see this coming. We knew it was going to come to a head in June, the end of June, and at the end of March, toward the end of March, Yanis asked me if I would help prepare a contingency plan, the so-called Plan B. What if Greece is forced to leave the Eurozone? That became my secret responsibility. Hiding in plain view, so to speak, since it was well known that I was close to him and that we were working together, but nobody suspected, since we had a reputation for talking too much, nobody suspected that we could keep a secret. I spent 6 weeks with a team working out what the course of action would have to be. Unfortunately, or well, for better or for worse, the Greek government at the higher levels had no interest in pursuing that, and therefore, whatever leverage it might have had, and I think there would have been very little or none, from it being known that there was such a plan, was not ever going to be exploited. What happened really at that point was very simple. Time ran out, the negotiations continued at an impasse with absolutely no concessions. The Greek government made 3.5 billion euro of debt payments in order, as a sign of good faith, in order not to fall in default to the IMF in particular. It drained all of its reserves. It drained its universities. It stopped paying its healthcare providers. It drained its municipalities. It was running a negative balance in the treasury of a few hundred euro toward the end of each month. The European Central Bank applied intense pressure to the Greek banking system, basically making it very clear to depositors that that their deposits were at risk, and encouraging, which encourages people to pull their money out in cash or to buy automobiles or whatever it is that they can hold value if their bank deposits are a threat. Also to move money out of the country. The foreign banks that had lent to the Greek banks cut off those credits. The Greek banks became even more dependent on the European Central Bank, which then became tighter and tighter, until it became clear that that they had a move which would force Greece to impose capital controls. That happened at the end of June. The Greek government, realizing that it was that it was not going to succeed in getting concessions, found itself cornered and called a referendum on the terms of the bailout of the memorandum of what was being imposed on it. Called the referendum with the expectation that the Greek people would collapse, would crumble, that they would not withstand the strain of the threat of seizure of their bank deposits and the intense media campaign that was telling them that the world would come to an end if they refused the terms, plus every European leader was telling them that they would be thrown out of the euro if they refused the terms. And it was an interesting thing that happened. Interesting thing that happened was that the Greek people were not intimidated. They stood up. They stood up really magnificently. When capital controls were imposed, we didn't know what the public reaction would be. We thought there might be riots, protests, demonstrations. Nah. People lined up at the ATMs so that they could flirt. We're talking Athens, summertime, right? People were prepared. They had cash in their, you know, some people were affected seriously, but most people were prepared. They had cash set aside. They could still make payments inside the Greek banking system, so the payments that you couldn't make were to, you know, an automobile supplier in Germany. Well, it's too bad for them, right? A classmate of mine from many years ago, a woman friend, said to me, you know, sex is way up this week. And when the vote came, the Greek people voted no, 61.5%. A magnificent, defiant no to the intimidation that was being. But the government was not prepared mentally or practically to withstand the pressure that it was under. And when that became clear the night of the referendum, Yiannis resigned his post the following morning. I left the next day. Alexis Tsipras went back to Brussels, and after being waterboarded for 17 hours by his colleagues, he capitulated, and we came under the new memorandum of understanding, which, if it's anything, even somewhat more harsh than the previous one. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about a case study in just how tough and how really brutal financial and political interests can be, particularly when they are closely tied to each other. And we're talking about how, in this particular case, very brave people stood up to that attempted by force of rational argument to achieve a better situation for themselves and experience the weakness of rational argument in the face of political obstruction, financial power, and frankly, an element of obtuseness and vindictiveness thrown into the bargain. What will happen in Greece now? The moment people are exhausted with the banking situation somewhat stabilized, some of the pressures that were on the Greek economy that were aimed at the government in the first 6 months have been relaxed, so things will go on as they are for the time being. But what is going on in Greece is a politics of dispossession. The government is being asked to sell, once again, all of its assets. It's sold the airports, it's selling the port, electric company, and so forth. We're still discussing some of these details, some of these matters, but that's basically private investors grab what you can. Court reforms are being enacted to make it easier to foreclose and evict people from their homes. Greece is a very home-owning society, so that becomes another major social tension. And about 40,000 businesses, the last information I had, of the 250,000 that remain are expected to be bankrupt by the end of the year. A politics of colonization and dispossession. Colonization because the Greek government cannot even bring a law before its own parliament without getting the approval of its creditors. What we'll see in Europe as a result of this is interesting. The theory of the case on the creditor side is that you can intimidate people, and that if you do that effectively, they will acquiesce in being governed from Frankfurt and Berlin. And that was the idea that informed, I think, European politics until the Portuguese elections a couple of weeks ago, when 51% of the seats went to, guess what? Three parties of the left, the Socialists, the Left Bloc, and the Communist Party, which miraculously, since these parties have, particularly the Communists and the Socialists, have been enemies for decades, compose their differences and may well form a government in Portugal in the next few days. And we have Spanish elections coming up, and we'll see what happens there. It's not entirely clear at this point, but it's possible that the Spaniards will also stand up. So it's an interesting story. I know this is not so much an American story, but it is a story of an ongoing struggle. As I say, I was deeply engaged in it. It was a great privilege to be engaged in it. And I thought perhaps you'd be interested in hearing some of how it felt to be there. Thank you very much.